Films. It's presented by Susie Klein.
Very good evening to you. Yes, tonight the Budapest Festival Orchestra is preparing to give not one, but two concerts. Later on, it's our first ever audience choice prom, where the crowd here gets to pick whatever they want to hear from the orchestra's extensive repertoire. That's at 10 o'clock. Right now, though, they're gearing up to play music by two composers very close to the heart of tonight's conductor, Ivan Fischer, as he told me earlier.
Well, Liszt and Mahler, they are both daring innovators, I think. They were traditional composers of the time, people who, well, I wouldn't call them conservative, but who carried on a certain tradition, like Brahms, Dvorak, Tchaikovsky even. And they were clearly the pioneers, the people who wanted to change the world. And certainly Liszt was maybe next to Berlioz one of the most important ones. And this tradition of novelty led then to Wagner and especially Mahler. I think it's the same breed.
Ivan Fischer talking to me earlier today. Ivan Fischer, the founder and music director of the Budapest Festival Orchestra. So we begin tonight with music by Liszt. And he's at his most fiendish. It's the first Mephisto waltz. Let's not forget, this is a composer obsessed for so much of his life with that grand romantic anti-hero, Faust. Liszt writes several pieces based on that legend, the legend of the man who sells his soul to the devil. Notably Liszt's Faust Symphony, of course. We heard that earlier in the proms this season. There are several Faust legends floating around during Liszt's time. This one is a particularly hectic, sexually charged one right up Liszt Street. Here comes Ivan Fischer, then, to conduct Liszt's Mephisto Waltz number one. The Dance in the Village Inn, Liszt's first Mephisto waltz, based on Nikolaus Lenau's erotic retelling of Faust. Opening the first of two proms here tonight by the Budapest Festival Orchestra under its music director, Ivan Fischer. Leading the orchestra tonight, concertmaster Giovanni Guzzo. Well, the next piece tonight, it's music by Mahler. After the interval, we'll be hearing his first symphony, but right now we've Blumina, a movement that Mahler discarded from it. Why? Let's find out in a few moments as the players rearrange themselves. A few people coming off, going on here. But Blumina was originally conceived by Mahler as part of his very first stab at a symphonic work. However, he found it perhaps too sentimental, too pretty. It was discarded. We'll hear the whole symphony later, but now, Blumina.
Thank you.
Mahler's Intermezzo Blumina, Ivan Fischer conducting the Budapest Festival Orchestra. Music that Mahler described as a love episode, but which he felt was perhaps too sentimental to form part of his first symphony. Ivan Fischer told me earlier that despite that, it's still Mahler at his most uninhibited. The piece deserves its place, he told me, in the repertoire as a standalone concert work. Well, next this evening, we are back to the music of Franz Liszt and the instrument he played with such legendary fire and virtuosity, the piano. It's Liszt's Totentanz, or Dance of Death, a work for piano and orchestra that surges with terror, violence and fury. It's based on the Dies Irae, or Day of Wrath, a plain chant melody taken from the Latin Mass for the dead. From that, Liszt created a monster of a piece in the Totentanz, and it takes a real daredevil soloist to pull it off. Tonight, he comes in the form of Croatian pianist Dejan Lazic. I talked to Dejan earlier about how he gets himself ready to perform the piece. Does he do much research?
Definitely, research, not only knowledge about other Liszt works helps. We've performed quite often, especially this year, both concertos, which are so different from the Totentanz, but also going into other aspects. Liszt as a human being, as a politically engaged person. So it's really interesting to go deeper into his own world and how he understood music. And apparently, he never performed this piece the same way. It always tend to be between 18 and 23 minutes because he improvised quite a lot.
That's a vast difference, 18 and 23 minutes.
Imagine. So he could just improvise and go for it, and people urged him, his followers, his fans, to write these improvisations down. But he said, no, otherwise these would not be improvisations. This is just for the moment. And I think this is a crucial key word here, the moment. It's therefore very hard to record this piece because what version are you eventually going to take? It's not just enough to play the one, to take the one without wrong notes. It is far more than that. It's therefore so challenging.
Does that make it a very nerve-wracking experience to perform because you have no idea how it's going to turn out?
It is, in a way, like jumping off the cliff.
People talk about the very special qualities of tonight's conductor and tonight's orchestra. I'd love to know your perspective from the inside, working with them. What really makes this band different?
First of all, quite objectively, this orchestra is orchestra made out of soloists. It is really true in this case. The very last stand to the concertmaster, the winds, of course, they're all absolutely stunning chamber music players, soloists. And there is this idea, there is vision. This orchestra is not just another orchestra. It's been, already the name, Budapest Festival Orchestra. And of course, the spirit and the vision of Ivan Fischer, who in my opinion is definitely one of the most amazing, not only conductors, but musicians, personalities of the century.
Dejan Lazic.
Thank you. Dejan Lazic, the Croatian soloist, joining the Budapest Festival Orchestra and conductor Ivan Fischer in a performance of Franz Liszt's Dance of Death, the Toten Dance. The two twin passions of any great romantic artist, including Liszt, it was sex and death. For his part, Liszt famed in the 1830s for frequenting hospitals, gambling casinos and asylums, even went down into prison dungeons, apparently, in order to see those condemned to die, all in the name of musical research, of course. And Liszt has quite a reputation in Ivan Fischer's family. Apparently, he taught Fischer's great-grandmother to do the Viennese waltz. Well, Lazic is back on stage, striding on at an incredible pace, and he's back at the piano stool too. Warmly thanking these players. He works an awful lot with this band and this conductor. They're about to tour together. They're going to Beethoven Fest in Bonn, then to Milan, to Belgium early next year. Sees them in the United States together. So an incredible rapport, really lovely, warm chemistry between all these players. And Ivan Fischer applauding our soloist now, along with all the members of the orchestra. Hands held between conductor and soloist, warmly held aloft, punching the air together. You might remember Lazic has already been at the Proms this season, doing his arrangement of Brahms, the violin concerto. And he's back on stage with some different music.
Younger members of the audience will easily recognize the tune. Enjoy. Thank you.
I think it's safe to say the audience rather enjoyed that. That was Giovanni Dettori's Fugue in D minor. And if you did recognise it, yes, the theme is taken from Lady Gaga's hit Bad Romance. Full marks if you guessed that. That piece, apparently a huge internet hit, written by Dettori, apparently in order to explain to people how Baroque musical techniques like counterpoint work. An eloquent explanation, if ever there was one. Given here at the Proms by Dejan Lazic, the Croatian pianist and composer. Told me earlier today he's, apart from all of his soloist engagements, he's also busy working on a piano concerto of his own, a five-movement piece. He's been at it for 4 years, he tells me. He reckons he's got another two to go until it's finished, so we look forward to that. Well, it's time now for an interval of around 25 minutes or so before the second half of this evening's concert. Still to come, music by the composer with whom Ivan Fischer has such a close affinity. It's Mahler, the first symphony live at the Proms. In the lead up to that, our interval feature, a short story by another Austrian master, Josef Roth. He was born in 1894 in a remote corner of the Habsburg Empire and wrote a number of stories full of wit and unsentimental nostalgia for the Austro-Hungarian culture he saw disappearing before his eyes. Station Master Falmaria by Josef Roth is read by Ian Glenn in a translation by Michael Hoffman.
The strange story of the Austrian station master Adam Falmaria deserves without a doubt to be written down for posterity. He lost his life, which, let it be said, would never have been a glittering one, and perhaps not even a satisfying one, in the most extraordinary way. He had been a station master since 1908. Shortly after taking up his post in the station of L, 2 hours south of Vienna, he married the daughter of a chancery councillor from Braun. A good woman, slightly dim, no longer in the first flush of her youth. In marrying, Falmaria followed not the voice of common sense, but the cool prompting of his cool heart. He became a father of twin girls, and he cared for them with the traditional diligence of a father and loyal official. One day in March 1914, Adam Falmaria, as usual, was sitting in his office. It was 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Although the sun hadn't gone down yet, what with the rain, it was already starting to feel dark. Even though Station Master Falmaria was hardly of a fanciful cast of mind, this day still struck him for some reason as a fateful day, and as he looked out of the window, he felt himself beginning to tremble. In 36 minutes, the express to Marana was due to pass through. In 36 minutes, so Falmaria thought, the night would be at hand. A dreadful night. And on that day there occurred the overwhelming catastrophe whose consequences were to transform Adam Falmaria's life. The express was already running slightly late when it left the town of B. 2 minutes before it was due in L, because of some incorrectly set points, it ran into the back of a waiting freight train. The catastrophe had happened. Station Master Falmaria ran along the tracks towards the place of the accident. Railwaymen and firemen and passengers were pulling at the wreckage with any tools they could find. The station master shivered as he stood in the rain. He had the sense that he ought to do something like everyone else, but at the same time he was afraid he might not be allowed to help because he might be to blame for the accident himself. His aimlessly wandering eye lit on a woman who had just been brought out on a stretcher. There she lay, abandoned by the volunteers who had rescued her, her huge dark eyes staring at the torches nearest to her, draped from shoulders to hip in a silvery grey fur, and quite evidently not able to move. Her slim, white hands lay on the fur, unmoving as well, two beautiful corpses. Was she perhaps already dead? Station Master Falmaria slowly approached the stretcher. The woman was alive. When Falmaria bent down to her, she said there was nothing the matter with her, and that she thought she could get up. Falmaria helped her to do so. He took her fur in his left hand, and with his right he took the woman by the shoulder, waited for her to get up, and so they walk the few paces over the gravel and the rails to the hut of a pointsman nearby.
"Just rest here for a minute or two," said Farmer Eyre. "I have things to attend to outside. I'll be back very soon."
Even though he wanted nothing more than to stay with the woman, it was too terrible to stand before her as a useless idler. So he plunged outside, and to his own astonishment he found he now had the courage and strength to assist and to rescue, to give a command here and a bit of advice there, even though all the time he was thinking about the woman in the hut. In passing, he told the doctor, whom he knew, that there was one more victim of the catastrophe sheltering there. "Kindly examine the lady," he said to the doctor, and he himself walked outside. The doctor came out and said, "It's a minor shock. Nothing worse. She should probably stay here for a while. Can you put her up in your apartment?" Farmer Eyre gave the woman his room and his bed. The station master's wife was kept shuttling between her and the children. Twice a day, Farmer Eyre put in an appearance. The evening after the disaster, Farmer Eyre learned the name of the woman. She was a Countess Velievska, a Russian who came from the Kiev region and had been on her way from Vienna to Murano. Part of her luggage was found and returned to her, black and brown leather suitcases. They smelled of leather and an unfamiliar perfume, the scent of which now dominated Farmer Eyre's entire apartment. He slept, since he had given his own bed to the woman, not in the bedroom next to Frau Farmer Eyre, but downstairs in his office. Or rather, he didn't sleep. He lay awake. In the morning, at 9 o'clock, he entered the room where the woman lay with her large dark eyes and strong white face, as wide as a strange sweet landscape.
"Won't you sit down?" she said to him, every day, twice.
Farmer Eyre would not sit down. "Excuse me, I'm busy," he said, turned on his heel and walked out. For 6 days it was like that. On the 7th, the doctor told the woman she could travel. Her husband was waiting for her in Murano. So she went, leaving behind in every room, and most especially in Farmer Eyre's bed, an inextinguishable smell of leather and an unfamiliar perfume. The strange scent remained in Farmer Eyre's apartment, in his memory, yes, one could even say in his heart, for much longer than the accident. Secretly, he was hoping for news of the woman with every post, and one day a large dark blue letter arrived from Italy. It was a short letter. Farmer Eyre quickly knew it by heart. He knew the exact position of each word. Written in purple ink, in beautiful flowing strokes, the letters were like a beautiful swarm of exotic, slender, exquisitely plumed birds, soaring against a deep blue sky. The Countess had signed herself Anya Velievska.
"What a nice note," said his wife, and laid it aside.
The days went by, the months. A couple of colourful postcards winged their way north from Sicily with hurried greetings. Summer came, a hot summer. Then the general mobilisation was at hand. Farmer Eyre was ensign in the reserves with the 21st Rifles. He was sent to the front. He saw action. He was a brave soldier. He was decorated, was promoted to lieutenant. He was wounded. He was put in a field hospital. He was offered home leave. He turned it down and went back to the front. He fought in the East. He began to teach himself Russian from books he'd happened to pick up. Surrounded by the stink of gas and the smell of blood, Farmer Eyre pursued the strange scent of leather and the unfamiliar perfume of the woman who had once lain in his bed, on his pillows, under his covers. He learned the woman's mother tongue, and he imagined he was speaking to her, a woman from a hostile nation, in her language. He learned endearments, sweet nothings, love whisperings in Russian. He felt her living for him, waiting for him. When his battalion was transferred to the southern front, he found himself, because of his knowledge of Russian, seconded to one of the regiments that shortly afterwards were to make up the so-called Army of Occupation. Eventually, he found himself near Kiev.
It was easy enough to find out the name of the estate that belonged to the Valievsky family. It was called Solovki, and it was some 3 verses south of Kiev. Farmeraya felt a sweet and painful clutch of excitement. Farmeraya had the carriage made ready, and he set off. Will she be at home? Farmeraya asked himself. Will she understand me? And the closer he came to the Valievsky estate, the more brightly the question burned in his heart. The Countess, of course, didn't recognize him. I'm Farmeraya, said the officer. Of course, the name meant nothing to her. Well, you don't remember, he began again. I'm the station master in L. She stepped nearer, took his hands, and there it was, the scent that had followed him for time immemorial. Oh, you must have so much to tell me, exclaimed the Countess. He told her in the most cursory terms how he had got on. She was pouring tea when he suddenly asked, Where's your husband? Why, at the front, of course, she said. I haven't had any news of him for 3 months. Are you very worried about him? Asked Farmeraya. Well, of course I am, she replied. Just as your wife is about you, I expect. Oh, I'm so sorry. I wasn't thinking, said Farmeraya. He stared into his teacup. She had refused, the Countess continued, to leave the house. She was not about to flee either from her own peasants or from the enemy. Her money and her jewels were... She groped for the word. She had forgotten how to say buried in German, and she pointed to the ground. Farmeraya said it in Russian. Well, do you speak Russian, then? She asked. Yes, he said. I learnt it in the army. And he added in Russian, It was for you, to be able to talk to you, that I learnt Russian. She told him he spoke it remarkably well, as though his last sentence had been nothing but a linguistic exercise. But her response showed him that she had taken his meaning. He left, and he no longer had any doubt that his destiny was beginning to fulfill itself. It is a law, he said to himself. It is not possible for one person to be so irresistibly drawn to another, and for the other to remain indifferent. 2 days later, he drove out to Solovki again. Did he want some lunch? Asked the Countess, seeing as it was midday. Yes, he replied. The Countess talked about the outbreak of war, how they had hurried back from Cairo, of her husband's guards regiment, of his comrades, then about her childhood. It was as though she were desperately casting about for things to say. He stroked his little blonde moustache and gave every appearance of paying close attention, but in fact he was far more attentive to her fragrance than to what she was saying. His paws were listening, and anyway her speech was scented to the words she spoke. When they got up, he said he would be taking a much longer furlough in a few days' time, once he'd been promoted to first lieutenant. Where was he thinking of going? Asked the Countess. Nowhere, said Farmeraya. I'd stay here with you. She invited him to stay as long as he liked. If he cared to stay, there were plenty of rooms. They wouldn't get in each other's way. Perhaps a week after this visit, the newly promoted first lieutenant Adam Farmeraya was given his furlough. He went to the house of the Valievskys, moved into a ground floor room that had been made ready for him, and took his meals every day with the lady of the house. At night, he didn't sleep. Just as he hadn't slept those years before at home in the station building, during those 6 nights the Countess had spent in his room, overhead. Once more he had a sense of her over him at night, over his head, over his heart. One night, it was humid and a good relieving rain began to fall, Farmeraya got up, dressed, and went outside. He saw Countess Valievska coming down the stairs. She was dressed as if for the day. He bowed silently. She came up to him. Farmeraya could hear his heart beating. He thought he could hear her heart beating as loud as his own and in time with it. Farmeraya said, Let's walk in the rain. I'll get you a coat. And without waiting to hear what she would say, he plunged into his room, came out with his own coat and laid it round the shoulders of the woman, just as he had once laid her fur on that one unforgettable night of the disaster, and then he laid his arm over the coat.
and so they walked out into the night and the rain. They walked down the avenue of birches. He pressed his arm more tightly around the woman's shoulder and felt, through the stiff, sodden material, the yielding kindness of her body. His hand left her shoulder, moved up to her wet hair, brushed over her wet ear, touched her wet face. And a moment later, they both stopped as one, turned to one another, clasped each other. The coat slipped from her shoulders and fell heavily to the ground. And so, in the rain and the night, they pressed their faces together, their mouths together, and they kissed and kissed. Every morning and evening, First Lieutenant Farmeria blessed the war and the occupation. Nothing terrified him as much as a sudden return of peace. He thought of Count Valievsky as long dead, either killed in action or murdered by mutinous communist troops. The war simply had to go on indefinitely. But of course, quite heedless of him, the great and inscrutable wheel of the world was rolling on. The revolution came. Farmeria, the amorous first lieutenant, hadn't seen it coming. Even so, the sudden stroke of the hour of destiny roused his sleepy brain, and with renewed alertness he saw that he had to save the lives of his beloved and himself, and above all to rescue their union. A profound instinct told the two lovers that at a time when the whole of the earth was plunged into chaos, the eternal sea must be the only place that would guarantee them freedom. Therefore the sea became their first objective, and in an excited but confident frame of mind, they drove off. Several weeks later, Farmeria and his beloved reached Monte Carlo, where the Valievskis had bought a small villa before the war. Now Farmeria thought he had reached the pinnacle of happiness and life. He was loved by the most beautiful woman in the world. More, he loved the most beautiful woman in the world. The woman who, only a little while ago, had been too proud to listen to the voice of her heart and her senses, this woman now had no other aim or desire in life than to be the mistress of Farmeria, the station master of the Austrian Southern Railway. Even though Countess Valievska had her Farmeria all to herself, she still was incapable of loving for long without fearing the loss of her beloved. For often it is a woman's fear of losing a man that heightens her love and her passion for him. So one day she began to ask him to divorce his wife and renounce his children and his job. Straight away, Farmeria wrote a letter to his cousin Heinrich, saying that he had irrevocably broken with his past life and that he was eager that a well-qualified lawyer be found to expedite the divorce in his absence. Heinrich's reply came a few days later. 2 years had elapsed since Farmeria had been listed as missing, and since he had at no time given any sign of life, his wife and few remaining relatives all supposed him to have died. It seemed simplest to remain silent, always assuming that Farmeria didn't run into difficulties over his passport or the like. Farmeria thanked his cousin and enjoined him to silence. He showed the correspondence to his beloved. Her mind was set at rest. She fell pregnant. Farmeria was beside himself with joy. Then one day a stranger turned up at the villa of the Valievskis, a Caucasian by the name of Kurdzashvili, who informed the countess that by some providential chance, and probably with the help of the icon of St. Procopius in the monastery of Pokrozhny as well, the count had managed to survive the dual perils of war and the Bolsheviks, and was even now on his way to Monte Carlo. During the Caucasian's visit, Farmeria said not a word. He escorted the visitor out of the house for a short distance. When he returned, he felt for the first time in his life a sharp, sudden stabbing in his chest. His mistress was sitting at the window, reading.
"Well, you can't let him find us here," said Farmeria. "We have to run away."
"I'm going to tell him everything," she replied. "We'll stay." "You're carrying my child," said Farmeria. "It's an impossible situation." "You'll stay here till he comes. I know him. He'll understand," replied the woman. From that time forth, they didn't exchange another word about Count Valievsky. They waited, till one day a telegram came from him,
He was coming on such and such an evening. They went to meet him at the station. Two guards lifted him out of the carriage, and a porter came along with a wheelchair. He was put in the wheelchair. He held out his long, bony, yellow face towards his wife. She bent down and kissed him. With long, bony hands that were blue with cold, he kept trying, unsuccessfully, to pull a couple of brown rugs over his knees. Farmeraya came to his aid. The Count was wheeled along the platform like one of his many pieces of luggage. He had to be lifted into the car. Farmeraya and the chauffeur did it together. He had to be carried into the villa. Farmeraya took him by the head and shoulders. The servant took his feet. "I'm hungry," said Count Valievsky. When they laid the table, they learned that Valievsky was unable to feed himself. His wife had to feed him. And when, following a grim, silent dinner, it was time for bed, the Count said, "I'm tired. Put me to bed." Countess Valievska, the servant, and Farmeraya bundled the Count up the stairs to his room on the first floor, where a bed had been made ready. "Good night," said Farmeraya. He saw, out of the corner of his eye, his mistress plump up the pillows and sit down on the side of the bed. And then Farmeraya left. Nothing has ever been heard of him since.
Ian Glenn was reading Station Master Farmeraya by Josef Roth, translated by Michael Hoffman. It was abridged and produced by Emma Harding. Well, a very warm welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall in London from me, Susie Klein. We are live on Radio 3 for this evening's prom, the first of two concerts here tonight given by the Budapest Festival Orchestra under founder conductor Ivan Fischer. We've just one work left on the bill for this concert. It's the first symphony by a composer Ivan Fischer feels a deep musical and personal connection with, Gustav Mahler.
It is, of course, very stunning to know that both European premieres, actually, of this piece were a huge fiasco.
Well, apologies there. We played slightly the wrong clip. I think in our excitement, we played you something from Dejan Lazic, who was on earlier. I think we're going to try and see if that clip's ready for you to listen to now.
He comes from the same background, this kind of Austro-Hungarian, assimilated, Jewish surroundings where people stepped out of religion and culture became their religion. So they threw themselves at cultural values with the same obsession and fanatism as to religion a few generations earlier. This is a very clearly recognizable little subculture in Central Europe. And what I read of Mahler is very much like my own family. It's really extremely similar. Now, that may be one explanation, but I think it goes deeper than that. I'm probably the same type of neurotic, strange person. I really don't know. I see a lot of craze in Mahler's music in a good sense, and I get very excited, and I find most of his unpredictable twists completely predictable. So I don't know how else to explain the link. It's intuitive.
What for you is Mahler trying to get us to feel and to think? And how does he want us
to
respond?
It's his own soul. I think Mahler was a person with extreme emotions, extreme feelings. And when the music seemed pale to him or it didn't correspond to his a scale of emotions, what he wanted to express. He was an extreme personality, and he needed extreme sounds and effects, also musical contrasts, to say what he wanted to say, which was his very honest expression of himself. I think Mahler has an enormous following now everywhere. And if you really ask the question, why is that? Why is Mahler so popular compared to maybe 50 or 80 years ago, when He even seemed somebody who was slightly tasteless, you know, like somebody suspicious and not really good enough. My answer would be that people discovered his honesty.
Ivan Fischer on Mahler, such an ardent fan, this conductor, of this composer. He calls him one of the great geniuses of music history. So here he is to conduct Mahler's first symphony with his orchestra, the Budapest Festival Orchestra.
Thank you. Thank you.
Ivan Fischer, conducting Mahler's First Symphony without a score. By the end of that, all the brass players, all the winds on their feet, blasting that music out into the Royal Albert Hall. That piece, such an incredible collage of a fertile musical imagination, and played so sympathetically, so idiomatically by the players of the Budapest Symphony Orchestra, led tonight by their concertmaster Giovanni Guzzo. Well, the premiere of Mahler's First Symphony, conducted by Mahler in Budapest, while Mahler was in charge of the opera there for a few years. This performance by the Budapest Festival Orchestra, given by conductor Ivan Fischer, who also, incidentally, is the founder of the Hungarian Mahler Society. Well, I don't know how, but they've got to come on stage again in 45 minutes and do it all over again, although we will be seeing the lighter side of these players. Just under an hour they have to regroup, have a quick cuppa. All taking applause now, bows for Ivan Fischer, carrying a very large bouquet of red roses as he sprints off stage. Yes, they've got 50 minutes or so to have a quick cuppa, perhaps a stiff drink, which they have certainly earned. They've got to turn themselves around, come right back on stage here at the Royal Albert Hall. It is our audience choice prompt. If you are in the audience, you get to decide what this orchestra plays. We are promised by Ivan Fischer a tuba, roving the aisles, raffle tickets, possibly some cuddly toys, several very busy librarians trying to hand out all the right parts. Section applause for trombones and trumpets there. And the timpanists too. And for the basses, fantastic, wonderful low bass sound, giving support to that huge symphonic collage there. Everybody now on their feet. So if you want to hear more from this fabulous orchestra, we ask you to join us. Catherine Bock will be here for that second concert, 10 o'clock. But for now, it's time for me to hand you back to John Shea at Broadcasting House.
Susie, thank you very much. That was Susie Klein presenting the first of tonight's two proms by the Budapest Festival Orchestra. And you've another chance to hear that concert on Sunday afternoon here on BBC Radio 3 at 2 o'clock. Or, of course, you can use the iPlayer to listen to it again anytime you like over the next 7 days. bbc.co.uk/radio3.
The final week of the 2011 BBC Proms season continues with Seven Heavenly Bodies. Holst's evergreen masterpiece, The Planets. The BBC Symphony Orchestra and conductor David Robertson are also joined by violinist Christian Tetzlaff for an eagerly awaited UK premiere of a new concerto by Sir Harrison Birtwistle. Wednesday night at the BBC Proms, starting at 7 o'clock.
Well, before that, we have Prom Live from the Royal Albert Hall tomorrow night, given by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales. It's British first half, Elgar's Cocaine Overture, the first London performance of Michael Barclay's Organ Concerto, David Good is the soloist in that, and after the interval, Marc-André Amelin plays Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a theme of Paganini, and Kodály's Hari Janos suite ends the programme. So that's live from the Proms tomorrow night on Radio 3, beginning at the earlier than usual time of 7 o'clock. But back with Mahler in between tonight's two proms, in 5 minutes or so, we'll be Walking with Freud, a record of the recreation, I should say, of the only recorded meeting between Mahler and Freud in the summer of 1910. That's our feature in 5 minutes or so. So before then, let's hear Marc-André Amelin, tomorrow night's solo pianist, on disc. This is a recording he's made recently of music by Nikolai Roslovets. From 1914, these are three compositions.
Thank you.
Music by the Russian composer Nikolai Roslavets. That's not actually a recent recording, as I said earlier. Marc-André Amelin made that recording, in fact, in the late 1990s. And those were three compositions from 1914 by Nikolai Roslavets. And as I mentioned, you can hear Marc-André Amelin as the soloist tomorrow night at the Prom, playing Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a theme of Paganini. And there's more piano music in Monday night's Prom.
She made her BBC Proms debut a decade ago. Now she returns to London's Royal Albert Hall to play the same work in 2011. Pianist Hélène Grimaud plays Beethoven's evergreen fourth piano concerto in the first of a pair of concerts by the Pittsburgh Symphony and its current music director, Manfred Honeck. I'm Susie Klein. Join me this Monday night at 7:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3, where the time is now 9:15. And with the sound of Mahler's First Symphony still fresh in our ears, we come to this evening's feature, a second chance to hear Walking with Freud. On the 26th of August 1910, Gustav Mahler met Sigmund Freud, by arrangement, in a café in the Dutch city of Leiden. This is the only recorded meeting between these two great men from Vienna. They then spent 4 hours walking around the city, talking as they went. 100 years later, in the summer of 2010, the psychoanalyst Anthony Cantle, fellow of the Institute of Psychoanalysis in London and a member of the Gustav Mahler Society, met in Leiden with the composer David Matthews, thus recreating this meeting between Freud and Mahler. During that summer of 1910, Mahler had been working on his 10th symphony, but it was left incomplete when he died the following year. David Matthews helped with the orchestration of Derek Cook's performing version of Mahler's 10th symphony, and so he will forever be linked with this great masterpiece.
Almost exactly 100 years ago, in August 1910, Mahler came here to meet Freud, to consult him about the breakdown of his marriage. His wife, Alma, was having an affair with Walter Gropius. This has absolutely shattered him. And he was in a terrible state. And he was persuaded that it would be a good idea to come and talk to Freud, which he did. And he came to Leiden because Freud was on holiday nearby, and he was willing to interrupt his holiday to meet and talk with Mahler. Mahler, a very famous man, as Freud knew, and so that was enough for Freud to break his holiday where he didn't see patients. And for Mahler, it was a very long, arduous journey from Toblach, his summer home, a night's journey in a train, and he would return immediately after the consultation back to Toblach. So it was a very, it was quite an undertaking for both of them to have this talk, a very important talk. I've been influenced, I know, by Mahler in my own composing, and I very much sympathise with him as a composer. I mean, his attitude to music is something that I share, where you really put your life into your music. I mean, I know exactly what that means, because I feel the same about music, really. I've come to Leiden to meet the psychoanalyst Anthony Cantle, and together we're going to recreate Freud's and Mahler's walk around the town, and we're going to discuss what they talked about, what they might have talked about, and how it benefited Mahler, and what it meant to Freud.
Hello, David.
Hello.
Hello.
I hope you had a good journey.
I did, and I think I shall refer to you from this point on as Herr Mahler.
Yes, I came like Mahler by train. Yes. I don't think you came by tram.
No, no. I incurred an increase in carbon footprint and took a plane to Amsterdam and then a fast train to Leiden.
And it's a lovely day here. We're sitting in a cafe by a canal, very quiet at the moment.
Much as we understand Mahler and Freud did 100 years ago. So Freud is here on holiday, about 10 miles from Leiden, tram ride away, about an hour's length. He's having his annual vacation on the coast. A difficult time for him. He's exhausted. He's had a long analytic year, stopping work, curiously and interestingly, as I did myself just before this weekend, most analysts taking the August break. I think Mahler's arrived about 4:30 in Leiden, and they walk until sunset around the canals and the streets. So it's just a one-off meeting.
Mahler, in common with many artists, I think, was rather suspicious of psychoanalysis. Yeah. We do have something he said about it. He said, Freud, he tries to cure everything from one particular standpoint, i.e. sex, I suppose. But I think that he was rather reluctant to put himself under an analyst, in case, in fact, the productive neuroses which drove his composition disappeared and he was no longer able to compose.
We do know that Mahler was offered 3 appointments, cancelled the first 2. Analysts like myself would see that as not at all unusual, a rather healthy ambivalence and terror and fear of what a psychoanalytic consultation might involve. And then he finally accepts the third meeting here in Leiden. It's also, I think, important to understand that at the same time, whatever those terrors or worries may have been for Mahler in seeking Freud's help, he was also a working musician, a conductor. He'd settled the rehearsals and the other work connected with the Eighth and was busy looking and working on the Tenth Symphony. That's right, isn't it, David?
Yes, yes. I mean, he was composing absolutely intensely. He produced the whole score of what he did in a matter of 6 or 7 weeks. It's something like 167 pages, I think, of manuscript. It's an extraordinary amount. Yes. And a piece lasting 1 hour and 20 minutes.
So he would have had other reasons other than internal anxieties and terrors for delaying the meeting. These two men have many things in common, both from similar areas on the Czech-Moravian-Bohemian border, non-observant Jews, but steeped nevertheless in Jewish culture.
Both Mahler and Freud were first sons, weren't they?
Yes. And favourite.
And favourites, yes. Yes. There was a child before Mahler who died in childbirth,
yes.
But Mahler was the first survivor and therefore became the favourite son,
yes.
As Freud did.
Yes. One of 14 children.
Mahler was one of 14 children, yes. 8 of whom died in infancy.
Yes.
And then 2 more died later. He had a favourite brother, Ernst, who died when he was 13.
Yes.
And then he had another brother who committed suicide.
Yes, yes.
So it was a tragic upbringing, absolutely tragic.
And we see that, don't we, in all of his compositions.
Yes.
This constant thematic emphasis on sorrow, death, loss,
yes.
Dying, suffering.
But also on overcoming it.
Yes,
making some sense of life.
Yes, yes. I'm so glad you said that, David, because this is my own reading about Mahler's tremendous contribution through his music, what I would call the language of achievement, which transcends that nihilistic despair that one could easily forgive him for collapsing in the face of, that he actually was able to bring through his music such a sense of achievement and understanding through loss and suffering.
Yes.
The other interesting thing, which has certainly puzzled me, and I think it's unprecedented for Freud, why did he agree to meet someone on vacation? Now, of course, what he said to colleagues is that he couldn't resist an attempt to help a man of Mahler's worth.
A man like Mahler,
a man
he
like
said,
Mahler,
yes,
yes,
indeed.
Yeah.
I mean, he was interested in genius, wasn't he? The idea of genius. He'd just written his book about Leonardo.
Yes, that's right.
Obviously, yes, a man like Mahler. I mean, yes. Mahler's the most famous man in Vienna.
Yes.
How could Freud resist it?
And more famous than Freud at that time. That's very important.
Certainly,
that
yes.
we should understand that Mahler was more well-known and more successful. Freud on his way up, as it were,
yes.
But some years yet to come for his major works.
Yes, it had taken Freud a long time, really. Freud was older than Mahler. Freud was 54, Mahler was 50.
54, Mahler 50, yes.
For both of them, the prevailing anti-Semitism in Austria was a hindrance, but I think that both of them overcame it absolutely, didn't they? But I mean, I can ask you this, Anthony. Was psychoanalysis attacked in its early days for being a peculiarly Jewish thing?
I think it wasn't so much attacked, but I think the suspicion was there that it was associated with Jews. And psychoanalysis and Judaism cannot be separated. The history is indivisible. But I think its primary challenge lay in the ideas that Freud had, which were absolutely revolutionary.
Yes.
Particularly, and controversially so, the idea of infantile sexuality. This was unheard of, people wouldn't speak of it. It was thought to be very, very controversial. So this was a man and a craft viewed with considerable suspicion, not, I think, particularly because Freud being a Jew, but because of his ideas.
Yes. During their four-hour conversation, Mahler obviously revealed a great deal about his own life to Freud. But one wonders if Mahler would have learned anything about Freud from him. Would Freud have spoken about his own life, do you think, at all, to encourage Mahler, perhaps?
Almost certainly not. He probably would have said a little bit, but not a great deal. The conventional and wholly unreasonable idea of a psychoanalyst being a complete blank screen, neutrality on two legs, is not the case. But Freud would have been discreet and thoughtful, and as a distinctive feature of any psychoanalyst, would have wanted to keep in mind who the patient was, who mattered most. So would have kept himself out of the picture in order to create a reasonably good opportunity for Mahler to feel free to speak. And we should say, I think, as well, that one very, very popular myth that has gone around is that Mahler was analysed by Freud. Mm. And of course, what we're talking about here today is that it occurred, this meeting, once. They only met the once for 4 hours, as we've said. And they walked and they talked, a kind of, not a walking cure, but an analytic consultation, conversation, not an analysis. We understand by psychoanalysis nowadays a daily meeting 4 or 5 times a week in Freud's time, perhaps on Saturdays as well, 6 days a week, for 50 minutes duration. So we are miles away from what would constitute an orthodox, ordinary psychoanalysis, these two men meeting only for the afternoon. Freud himself said of Mahler that he'd never met anyone who grasped psychoanalysis so quickly and so enthusiastically as Mahler had. Freud recognised that there was some real ability there. Mahler thought himself about his unconscious as a second self and spoke of it in that way.
Yes, he did. I think Mahler was quite unusual in understanding the workings of the unconscious in music.
Yes.
His statements about that, he made a very interesting statement to his friend Natalie Bauer-Lechner about how, when he was writing his Fourth Symphony, how he was able to pick it up 10 months later and start it again as if he'd been writing it yesterday, acknowledging that it was there present in his unconscious all throughout the winter months, and then he could just take up his pen and start again without any problem. I think as a composer, I would certainly agree with Mahler about trying to express a truth about everything I know, and in a way, I do see my music as a kind of autobiography. I express things. I express things that I feel, the best I can do, and it's also absolutely vital to me. I don't know what I would do if I didn't. I think I might need psychoanalysis if I didn't compose. But I think that it keeps me sane.
I mean, I must say, just sitting here on a Sunday morning in this beautiful part of Leiden, sun shining, these historic buildings, the canal site. It's really wonderful to be here, to have the opportunity to also to be in a place where for each of us, for Mahler and Freud, in our different views and ways of art in relation to both, where they were 100 years ago. This street, to my mind, feels the kind of street that Mahler and Freud might have walked along, with these wonderful cobbles and wrought iron lampposts.
Yes, no sign of the car anywhere.
No.
From Mahler, walking was a very important activity. He went for a walk every day, and he thought about his music, I'm sure, on those walks, as I do. And myself, I find walking very great stimulus to composing, to getting ideas for compositions.
He was a tremendously athletic man, and those who knew him and who've written about his physique and his capacities for quite strenuous swimming and walking.
And bicycling, too.
And bicycling, yes. David, look, let's not get any further in this walk without mentioning Alma Mahler.
Yes, Alma was an extraordinary woman who Mahler met when she was 19, and a great beauty, and a very intelligent woman who'd had bohemian education, really. So she was brought up in the world of artists. As a teenager, she had a relationship, and it wasn't a full-blown affair, with Klimt. And she'd had a love affair with Alexander von Zemlinsky, the composer, the teacher of Schoenberg, who gave her composition lessons. She was really quite a promising young composer when Mahler met her. She'd written what I think are really quite outstanding songs for a girl of her age, and she wanted to be a composer. Mahler met her, and he was bowled over by her, by her beauty and by her brains.
But not enough to tolerate, apparently, her own creativity.
No.
And it was a condition of marriage, wasn't it? Yes, cease her own composing.
That's right, they got engaged. Mahler sent her a long letter stating quite precisely what he expected of her. And one of the things was that she should give up her composing, because he said, you can't have two composers in the same. You can't have two composers who are married to each other, really.
I think he put it, didn't he? I want a wife, not a colleague.
Yes. And that was a terrible thing for Alma, really, but she accepted it. She accepted it because she wanted to get married to Mahler. She was conscious of Mahler's status, and she saw herself as becoming an important person in Vienna, even more than she was at the time. I mean, she was already quite a star, but she would have become a greater star, obviously, marrying the most famous man in Vienna, which she did, and she sacrificed that. We know that she resented it from her diaries, but she put up with it, and she became, although she wasn't an ideal housefrau, she became Mahler's wife, and it seemed to be quite happy, the marriage, for the first 5 years. They had two daughters. But although he recognized Alma's intelligence, he thought her opinions were very naive. And he writes about this at great length in that long letter.
Yes.
You're not really a developed person. In other words, really, you've got nothing much to say yet, and you've got to learn a lot more. But he wasn't really prepared to help her. He already assigned her to a role which she accepted, but with reluctance. And that reluctance became stronger and stronger. Anyway, their marriage was really fulfilled and happy, in more or less.
On those conditions.
On those conditions.
Yes.
Until
terrible thing that happened in 1907.
Which would be the death of Putzi, yes, the first child.
Yes, to whom Mahler was absolutely devoted.
Yes, and this child would have been about 4 and a half,
yes,
who died sadly from diphtheria. So sad. And this daughter to whom he was devoted and adored. And I think it says something about the rather narcissistic Alma that we're discussing and thinking about, that she was in her own way and does actually admit to this in her diaries, that she felt very competitive, quite rivalrous, quite envious, I think, of the relationship between Putzi and Mahler. And one might speculate, I think a therapist, an analyst would certainly do so, about the kind of guilt and the kind of miserable feelings that Alma would have experienced after the death of someone whom privately and secretly she perceived as a rival, albeit only a tiny child, but the love of her father for his daughter. And
what we don't know, I think, is whether they really satisfactorily worked out the loss in their marriage. Interestingly, Mahler's letters to her in 1907 and afterwards are always maintain this cheerful note. He never once mentions in her letters, you know, I hope you're okay, you know, and he doesn't say that sort of thing.
No,
he just talks on this in this usual either cheerful or high flown tone, talking about philosophy and so on and the things that had happened to him. But he doesn't actually. It's not. They're not very. In some ways, they're a bit impersonal, those letters.
Absolutely, strongly privileging denial about what had happened.
Yes.
And one gets the impression when I think about this now, what we would do in relation to a couple who'd lost a child. The idea that in 1907, where would they go? Nowadays, we would think very automatically that they would seek help, counselling, psychotherapy for their joint loss. Mm. One has a sense, when I read the literature about this, that Mahler took himself off to work and could do so and had this enormously important outlet, this place to sink his grief, his suffering, his own angst. But what of Alma? Now, whatever we make of her, and whatever we think about her, and she will have been a mother, first and last, who had suffered the loss of a child. And one has a sense that she probably had to bear this pretty much alone.
Alma calls him a psychopath,
yes,
in her memoirs.
Yes.
And that's why he decided to consult Freud. This is an extraordinary phrase to use. She wasn't... I have to say that Mahler was a very difficult man maybe to live with, but she was almost impossible. There were aspects of her character which were very, very difficult to accept. I mean, her need to be at the centre of things, to be a princess all the time in the limelight, to create dramatic situations,
yes,
to actually live her life like a novel. And if there weren't situations to be created, she would make them up. She would,
yes,
make them
to
restore herself to the center stage where she felt,
yes,
she belonged. That was very hard to deal
with.
She
had a palpable narcissism, that's true, and was histrionic in the extreme, and
yes,
did pretty much see herself as,
yes,
the center of,
yes,
the universe. I think what's very interesting about her description of her husband is actually the projection of her own psychopathy. In other words, one of the things that Alma certainly wasn't distracted by or suffered very much from was a sense of guilt, which is the hallmark of the psychopathic personality, an affectionless response where true guilt and understanding and empathy with someone else would be very limited, if non-existent.
Well, when Mahler found out about the affair, she didn't apologise at all. I mean, she started accusing Mahler, saying it was all his fault that had made her turn to someone else.
Yes, yes.
And this heightened Mahler's insecurity. It heightened his anguish.
Yes.
And she did nothing to alleviate that, it seems.
That's right. I'm just thinking about my own clinical experience, where one would perhaps see a couple in a situation such as the Mahlers found themselves, in which it's a very, very familiar device where the betraying spouse would try and foster and promote ideas and insecurities in the betrayed. I mean, one aspect in which we might find some compassion for Alma is something about how she managed her own losses. We know that she lost her father at a very crucial age, on the cusp of adolescence, to whom she was very attached and devoted. She lost this younger child of 4 and a half. So one has a sense that
what does someone do? What did Alma do? And my own view always has been that what I think of and call Alma's signature tune is of a gross sexualization, an enactment and a defense against her own loss, an evasion and avoidance of her own mourning because of all the terrible things that happened in her own life. Now, of course, this is terrible and drove Marla perhaps nearly mad and other people as well. She was a tormentor and a narcissist, but there's no doubt that that perhaps was one of her ways of managing her own equilibrium, alcohol and sex.
Alcohol and sex, yes. Mm? We don't know whether she really enjoyed sex very much. It seems that she possibly didn't. She writes about it, you know, in her diaries as if she did, but then we can't believe really what necessarily anything she said. No. Well, some of it must be true. Yeah.
But in very gross sexualization, you would actually find that it wasn't the sex that was important. It wasn't the passion, the nourishment.
Yes.
It was the control, the usurping of the object, the incorporation of someone else, the sense of being connected with another, to do with presence and excitement, but very little to do with the other person and a pleasure and an enjoyment. Mm. If there was pleasure, it would be a pleasure associated with being able to use her formidable seductive talents to a particular end of a kind of triumph, a conquest of other people.
Now we come to the summer of 1910, and Alma's in a very bad way. She's already drinking far too much. She ended her life as a real alcoholic. She used to drink a bottle of Benedictine a day, apparently. And in June 1910, she goes off by herself to a spa in Tobelbad near Graz, and almost as soon as she arrives, she meets the young architect Walter Gropius, and they fall in love, and she begins an affair with him. This was the first real affair she'd had. She'd flirted with others, but she embarks on a full-scale affair, and clearly it was very important to both of them, from the tone of their letters anyway. And Mahler carries on writing the symphony and is in a terrible state. Sometimes he's crying, he's addressing poems to Alma, leaving them on her bed. He's in the most appalling condition.
She describes, doesn't she, that he's lying on the floor of the composing hut, writhing and crying.
Yes.
The prospect of losing her is just beyond him.
And he's in the position of a child calling for his mother.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
So something that interested me, we hear that by the time Mahler met Freud here in Leiden, that it was prompted by the breakdown of his marriage. But, you know, I don't know what you think, David, but I think it's also prompted by Mahler actually also, if not having very close to breakdown himself.
I think so. It was almost suicidal, his
mood.
I don't think he would ever have committed suicide. I think his will to live and to compose, to carry on composing, was always too strong for him to have done that. But he was absolutely desperate.
Yes.
What Freud says, Mahler came to consult him about, was that he could no longer love Alma in the way that he did.
Yes.
And a suggestion that he might have been impotent. I don't know whether he actually says impotent.
Withdrawn his libido, I think, was the...
She no longer excited him, that's right.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. It's interesting, you know, he was obviously still devoted to her in a way. I mean, but maybe the sexual side just had and he just saw her as this muse figure.
Mm.
He idolized Alma.
Yes.
He put her on a pedestal. She was a goddess, you know. She would not betray him in this way. He betrayed him. And he couldn't take this.
And you see, I think that betrayal, David, was in proportion to the investment that Mahler had in this relationship. We would understand this in psychoanalytic language. We would think about this, the investment, the transference to his own wife. Who was Alma? Of course, she was Mrs. Marlowe, but she was everything that this man was searching for, and also felt he'd lost the love of his mother, his siblings, many other things in life, the loss of his daughter. So here is this woman who, when he discovers the betrayal and the affair, the terror of losing her and all that she psychically stood for, as I would think of it and others, as a container for his own mind, much in the same way that good mothering approximates to that of a mother with a child being able